Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the planning and the preparation of the Gallipoli campaign, Britain and France and the British Empire's ill-fated intervention into the Dardanelles during the First World War. So we're reading mainly from Ottoman Endgame by Sean McMeekin, which is a really, really fantastic journey through the final years of the Ottoman Empire and the acceleration of the decline of the empire as a result of the First World War. As most scholars have pointed out, the British and the French actually underestimate the Ottoman Empire in 1914. And the Ottoman Empire between 1914 and 16 lays some pretty major blows on the British at Kut Al Amara, for example, and in the Dardanelles. But it is eventually the protracted nature of the war that grinds down all of the Central Powers. But the decision to invade at the Dardanelles, if we listen to Field Marshal Horatio Herbert Kitchener, in his representation to the British War Council on January the 7th, 1915, he said, "The Dardanelles appeared to be the most suitable objective, as an attack here could be made in cooperation with the fleet. If successful, it would re-establish communication with Russia, settle the Near Eastern question, draw in Greece and perhaps Bulgaria and Romania, and release wheat and shipping now locked up in the Black Sea." So, being able to control the Dardanelles, that narrow strait between the Black Sea and the Aegean, and eventually the Mediterranean, meant that there could be a flow of troops, supplies, and foodstuffs from southern Russia, perhaps to the British Empire, perhaps to British North Africa, perhaps all the way through the Mediterranean to Great Britain itself. But there was another motivation for attacking at the Dardanelles. And this came as a request and also an implied threat from Russia itself. Now, Sean McMeekin writes, on December the 30th, 1914, the Commander-in-Chief of Russia's armies, Grand Duke Nicholas, summoned Britain's military attaché, Major General Sir John Hanbury Williams, for an urgent audience at the Stavka in Baranovichi. Reports were pouring in from Tiflis in Georgia. The Turks, Nicholas told Britain, had mustered an army of 100,000 and were advancing on all fronts. Little wonder Tiflis' command was preparing to evacuate the entire Transcaucasus. Pitching the panic high, the Grand Duke complained that Russia had been forced to deprive the Caucasus of the better part of its troops to meet the common German threat, as desired by our allies, thus opening the path for Enver's crushing Sarkimi's offensive. Reminding the British attaché about the fragility of civilian morale in Russia, There had been a wave of strikes in St. Petersburg in July 1914, shortly before the war's outbreak, which peaked during the week of the French presidential summit. Nicholas warned that any further losses sustained against Turkey, Russia's favourite old punching bag, could be fatal to her ability to stay in the war. So Russia is putting an imagined gun to its own head and saying that if the British don't do something about this Turkish threat in Russia's southern flank, Russia might be forced to pull the trigger. And the implications for the British is if the Russians are knocked out of the war, Britain's war and the Anglo-French war in the West will be lost as well. Any current upswing in enemy morale, he told Hanbury Williams, could be sharply reversed, as there were many places in the Ottoman Empire where any force brought to bear could broadly compensate for Turkish victories in the Caucasus. So the Russians can leave it open as to where they think an attack against the Ottoman Empire should fall. But they strongly hinted at the idea that if Constantinople came under threat, that the Turks might give up. Now, the easiest way to place Constantinople under threat is to occupy the Dardanelles. But it seems as if the Grand Duke didn't have to really persuade the British very much. The British were keen for some kind of naval demonstration, as it was put in euphemistic terms, against the Ottoman Empire, and the Russians were very keen on this. So much so that when Hanbury Williams was finished with the Grand Duke, he went directly to St. Petersburg, which had now been renamed Petrograd, and he spoke with Sir George Buchanan, Britain's ambassador to Russia. Buchanan then sent a telegram to Sir Edward Grey on New Year's Day 1915, saying that it was important that Britain now do something to relieve the terrible pressure that Russia was facing. Grey sent this memo and the request, apparently from the Grand Duke, to Kitchener and Churchill, who met on Saturday, January the 2nd, 1915. And the extract that I read out at the beginning of the podcast, Kitchener's representation to the British War Cabinet, happened 5 days later. So you can see the pace of decision-making. And one of the routes that the decision-making flows from is these conversations taking place in Russia. Now, one of the great ironies was that at Sarikamish, the Russians routed the Turks during the 3 day period in which telegrams were passing forth between Russia and London. And also Sir John French, the head of the British Expeditionary Force on the Western Front, had reminded Kitchener that no troops could be spared for the Eastern Theatre. So there was, in some ways, little reason or purpose, based on the existing rationale, to go ahead with the Dardanelles campaign at all. However, Churchill had decided that it was a workable idea. Kitchener, too, really thought it was the way in which to get the war moving again. The reason why is that there was stalemate on the Western Front. The German defensive positions were almost impregnable from the Channel coast all the way to the Swiss border. And the British War Cabinet had little idea what else to do. They were at this, exactly the time that the Russians make this vague request about something that could happen in the Dardanelles. The British War Cabinet was actually debating about where a second front could emerge. So it's an unfortunate meeting of need and suggestion, time and circumstance. The head secretary of the War Council, Maurice Hankey, suggested that Germany can perhaps be most be struck most effectively and with most lasting results on the peace of the world through her allies, particularly through Turkey. Churchill had previously written to Asquith on the 29th of December, suggesting that there should be a diversion in the Baltics, which would draw Germany away from the Western Front. Quite how that would have been possible, and navigating through the Gulf of Finland and all the rest, full of floating mines and that kind of thing, it's difficult to ascertain. But Churchill's kind of enthusiasm for projects was very rarely tempered by their practicality at all. He read the Hanke Memorandum and began to consider that Turkey should be the likely target for a diversionary attack. The war cabinet quickly became divided between Easterners and Westerners, Westerners believing that there should be a renewed pressure on the Western Front, Easterners believing that the war could be won via the Ottoman Empire. Hindenburg was sufficiently alarmed about the possibility of a breakthrough at Alexandretta in the Ottoman Empire, that he thought that it might perhaps jeopardise the entire war. So they were definitely on to something. However, there were those who, in the war cabinet, that dismissed these notions, and many of the chiefs of the general staff believed that this couldn't be done either, and that it was a kind of a meaningless diversion and a sideshow. In part, their own egos and their own fixation on their own careers on the Western Front was to blame for this perspective. The Dardanelles were just one possibility when it came to an attack on the Ottoman Empire. Lloyd George thought that Syria might be the place to attack. The French were desperately against this, as they had Syria in mind for themselves should there be a defeat of the Ottoman Empire and a partition of the empire at the end of the war. They believed that there were long-standing kind of cultural and historic connections between France and Syria. So it remains curious as to why Kitchener was settled on purely on the Dardanelles so quickly, to the exclusion of other objectives in the Ottoman Empire, or perhaps even leaving the Ottoman Empire alone in its entirety. It also ignores the fact that there already had been a diversionary attack in the Ottoman Empire. The British had already invaded Mesopotamia, or modern-day Iraq, via the Shatt al-Arab waterway, and they had plans to march up the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers and to seize Baghdad. And there was the possibility, of course, that the Russians might meet them halfway and could participate in a joint operation. There was little possibility that the Russians could participate in the Dardanelles or by sending or send any troops to help and support. And there was the problem, and this is perhaps the most significant problem, is that the Germans had spent months building the Dardanelles into the most fortified area in the Ottoman Empire.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And it would be, in part, these fortifications that would defeat the Allied landings so successfully. Looking at the intelligence on the Straits' shore batteries, including those on the Sea of Marmara, the Russians now ruled out an attack on the outer Bosphorus, though one had been seen as more feasible as recently as July 1914. The Stavka, the Russian high command, concluded rather grimly that the favourable moment for seizing the Straits has been lost. And this was said in early 1915. So British wartime intelligence on the Ottoman Empire was not quite as good as Russia's. And Kitchener and Churchill might well have concluded the same thing if they had access to this intelligence, or if they had intelligence that good of their own. The defences of the Dardanelles had been vulnerable up to about August 1914, were now formidable in just a few months. The Dardanelles command, before the Germans had got involved, had 20 shore howitzers ranging from 15 to 28 centimetres, most accurate only at short range, although bigger guns had an extreme range of 15 kilometres. As the British knew, the main batteries were located at the southern tip of the Gallipoli Peninsula, Cape Helles, or Seddel Bar, as it was known by the Turks, and at Kumkale on the Asian shore opposite, with a second line of defence at the Narrows, at Kilid Bar on the European side, and at the forms of Hamidi and Chanak in Asia. What the British did not know was that the Germans had placed 170 gunnery experts, and they brought heavy naval guns, including 355mm Krupp cannon, which were mounted on the side of the south of Chanak. Many of the new mounted guns were cleverly camouflaged, while dummy batteries were erected elsewhere to draw off enemy fire. By the year's end, according to Sean McMeekin, there were enough guns that the Dardanelles command formed a 3rd Artillery Battalion to man a new howitzer zone behind the entry at the Kumkale Seddel Bar. And the Germans wrote, responsible for the delivery of plunging fire on enemy ships. So the British, due to poor intelligence that could easily have been provided by the Russians, but the Russians were rather too keen on drawing the British into creating a second front in the Ottoman Empire, were working into a bloodbath. Both sides of the Straits were covered in heavy guns, with mobile gun batteries, and with 5 on the European side and 3 on the Asian side. Of course, the Dardanelles is the straits by which Europe and Asia are separated. The German culture, the German military culture of discipline, had been instilled in the Turkish shore gunners. And so many of the values of German military efficiency had been imparted to them. German commanders were very impressed with the work ethic and the intelligence and commitment and dedication of Turkish troops. German NCOs were liberally dotted across the Dardanelles, and with nearly one German officer serving with every Turkish gun crew. The education of the Turkish gunners in the shore batteries wrote Guido Usedom, who was the chief engineer on the project of rebuilding the Dardanelles as a formidable defensive site. When he reported to the Kaiser, he said, "Has been a great success. The last firing drills into the straits demonstrated not only forward strides in accuracy, but also in the direction of batteries by Turkish officers, of whom a far greater number than was expected have proven themselves to be quick studies." When the American ambassador, Henry Morgenthau, toured the defences in 1915, he said that his view was that he had the impression that he was in Germany, for everywhere Germans were building buttresses with sacks of sand and in other ways strengthening emplacements. The scale of the disaster at Gallipoli and the level of official incompetence that led to it is well chronicled, because the public inquiry that happened afterwards where created a huge investigatory paper trial. The British Admiralty had basically no knowledge of the shore batteries along the Dardanelles. They had no knowledge of the reinforcements. They didn't seem to really have much knowledge that the Germans were there at all. One central flaw with the entire operation was that fighting British ships, no matter what they had faced, even though it had been fairly light opposition, would have had to have arrived off the shore at Constantinople heavily depleted after having fought and fired their way up the Dardanelles. And the Ottoman capital, unless there were vulnerable troop ships coming along with Britain's warships, wouldn't be able to seize the capital because there wouldn't be enough troops. So the initial phase of the operation up the Dardanelles, which was to break the Ottoman power along the Dardanelles and then hold the city of Constantinople at gunpoint, the initial phase that was meant to be done with naval power alone transpires, can't be done with naval power alone, as the British were about to find out. And therefore, the sceptics the sceptics who came out during the official inquiry, who lambasted the idea from its inception, were preparing their arguments even before the first ships set sail. One of these critics was Admiral Jackie Fisher, who, despite voicing misgivings in letters to Admiral Jellicoe, still had the ear of Churchill, and the two, until the Gallipoli disaster, were close friends. Fisher's scepticism led Churchill to contact Admiral Carden, who was commander of the Mediterranean Squadron, to ask him whether he thought that this mission would be possible. Carden came back and said yes, it would. On January the 11th, he produced a four-point plan for a naval-only operation along the Dardanelles, and the result was that Churchill then embraced the idea. On the 13th of January 1915, the First Lord of the Admiralty, Churchill, had received an intelligence report that suggested that the German ship, the Goeben, with which we've talked about before, that escaped into the Black Sea at the start of the First World War, had actually triggered Russian mines near the Bosphorus and now would be out of action until April. The second piece of information that Churchill came across was from Fisher, who had now changed his thinking, and suggested that whilst most of the attacking squadron would consist of older ships, Britain's new super dreadnought, the Queen Elizabeth, which was coming from Gibraltar, for gun trials, could try out its new guns in Turkey instead. So a German heavy cruiser out of action and a new dreadnought brought into play is enough to convince Churchill that this operation is a worker. Churchill said, "Once the forts were reduced and the minefields would be cleared and the fleet would proceed up to Constantinople and destroy the Goeben, they would have nothing to fear from field guns or rifles, which would be merely an inconvenience." Such words would later come back to haunt Churchill as the disastrous campaign would destroy his political career during the First World War, and it would only really rehabilitate itself towards the end of the conflict. But it seems above all that the British believed what they wished to believe about the Turks' ability to fight. Their underestimation of Turkish defences, their almost complete lack of any intelligence, and their motivation based on the requests of the Russians, which were disingenuous to say the least, were an example of kind of British hubris. It's possible to put forward the idea that under such circumstances that decision-making is always imperfect, but it's also possible to suggest that British imperial hubris and arrogance had led to a large part of this crisis. I'm going to be continuing in a week or two to examine the Dardanelles campaign, as there are several phases to the unfolding tragedy. But I'll leave you here, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. If you can swing by our Patreon page, if you enjoy these podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. We do have some very generous patrons that keep us going with a small flow of income, but obviously we're kind of flying a shoestring here. So any help you can give, much appreciated. Anyway, thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.